Something terrible happened at Lou's faculty party. It happened at 8:45, only 45 minutes or so after the first guests arrived. And Trent and Laurie later heard Lou shouting at their mother that the only goddamn consideration she had shown him was getting up to her foolishness early. If she'd waited until 10 o'clock or so, there would have been 50 or more people circulating through the living room, dining room, kitchen, and back parlor. "What the hell's the matter with you?" Trent and Laurie heard him yelling at her. And when Trent felt Laurie's hand creep into his like a small cold mouse, he held it tightly. "Don't you know what people are going to say about this? Don't you know how people in the department talk? I mean, really, Catherine, it was like something out of the Three Stooges." Their mother's only reply was soft, helpless sobbing, and for just one moment Trent felt a horrible, unwilling burst of hate for her. Why had she married him in the first place? Didn't she deserve this for being such a fool? Ashamed of himself, he pushed the thought away, made it gone, and turned to Laurie. He was appalled to see tears pouring down her cheeks, and the mute sorrow in her eyes went to his heart like a knife blade. "Great party, huh?" she whispered, scrubbing at her cheeks with the heels of her palms. "Right, Spratt," he said, and hugged her so she could cry against his shoulder without being heard. "It'll make my top 10 list at the end of the year, no sweat." It seemed that Catherine Evans, who had never wished more bitterly to be Catherine Bradbury again, had been lying to everyone. She had been in the grip of a screaming blue migraine for not just a day or 2 days this time, but for the last 2 weeks. During that time, she had eaten next to nothing and lost 15 pounds. She had been serving canapés to Stephen Crutchmer, the head of the history department, and his wife, when the colors went out of everything and the world suddenly swam away from her. She had rolled bonelessly forward, spilling a whole tray of Chinese pork rolls, onto the front of Mrs. Crutchmer's expensive Norman Kamali dress, which had been purchased for just this occasion. Brian and Lissa had heard the commotion and had come creeping down the stairs in their pajamas to see what was going on, although both of them, all four children for that matter, had been strictly forbidden by Daddy Lou to leave the upper floors of the house once the party began. "University people don't like to see children at faculty parties," Lou had explained brusquely that afternoon. "It sends all sorts of mixed signals." When they saw their mother on the floor in a circle of kneeling, concerned faculty members, Mrs. Crutchmer was not there. She had run for the kitchen, wanting to get some cold water on the front of her dress before the sauce stains could set. They had forgotten their stepfather's firm order and had run in, Lissa crying, Brian bellowing in excited dismay. Lissa managed to kick the head of Asian studies in the left kidney. Brian, who was 2 years older and 30 pounds heavier, did even better. He knocked the fall semester's guest lecturer, a plump babe in a pink dress and curly-toed evening slippers, smack into the fireplace. She sat there, dazed, in a large puff of gray-black ashes. "Mom! Mommy!" Brian cried, shaking the former Catherine Bradbury. "Mommy! Wake up!" Mrs. Evans stirred and moaned. "Get upstairs," Lou said coldly, "both of you." When they showed no signs of obeying, Lou put his hand on Lissa's shoulder and tightened it until she squeaked with pain. His eyes blazed at her out of a face which had gone dead pale, except for red spots as bright as dime-store rouge in the center of each cheek. "I'll take care of this," he said through teeth so tightly clamped they refused to entirely unlock even to speak. "You and your brother go upstairs, right? Nah, take your hand off her, you son of a bitch," Trent said clearly. Lou and all the partygoers who had arrived early enough to witness this entertaining sideshow turned toward the archway between the living room and the hallway. Trent and Laurie stood there side by side. Trent was as pale as his stepfather, but his face was calm and set. There were people at the party, not many but a few, who had known Catherine Evans' first husband, and they agreed later that the resemblance between father and son was extraordinary. That it was, in fact, almost as though Bill Bradbury had come back from the dead to confront his ill-tempered replacement. "I want you to go upstairs," Lou said. "All four of you. There's nothing here to concern you, nothing to concern you at all." Mrs. Crutchmer had come back into the room, the bosom of her Norma Kamali damp but reasonably free of stains. "Get your hand off Lissa," Trent said. "And get away from our mother," Laurie said. Now Mrs. Evans was sitting up, her hands to her head, looking around dazedly. The headache had popped like a balloon, leaving her disoriented and weak, but at last out of the agony she had endured for the last 14 days. She knew she had done something terrible, embarrassed Lou, perhaps even disgraced him, but for the moment she was too grateful that the pain had stopped to care. The shame would come later. Now she only wanted to go upstairs, very slowly, and lie down. You'll be punished for this, Lou said, looking at his four stepchildren in the nearly perfect shocked silence of the living room. He didn't look at them all at once, but one at a time, as if marking the nature and extent of each crime. When his gaze fell on Lissa, she began to cry. I'm sorry for their misbehavior, he said to the room at large. My wife is a bit lax with them, I'm afraid. What they need is a good English nanny. Don't be a jackass, Lou, Mrs. Crutchmer said. Her voice was very loud, but not very tuneful. She sounded a bit like a jackass in full bray herself. Brian jumped, clutched his sister, and also gave way to tears. Your wife fainted! They were concerned, that's all. Quite right, too, the guest lecturer said, struggling to extract her considerable bulk from the fireplace. Her pink dress was now a splotchy gray, and her face was streaked with soot. Only her shoes, with their absurd but engaging curly tips, seemed to have escaped, but she looked quite unperturbed by the whole thing. Children should care about their mothers, and husbands about their wives. She looked pointedly at Lou Evans as she said this last, but Lou missed her gaze. He was marking Trent and Laurie's progress as they assisted their mother up the stairs. Lissa and Brian trailed along behind, like an honor guard. The party went on. The incident was more or less papered over, as unpleasant incidences at faculty parties usually are. Mrs. Evans, who had slept 3 hours a night at most since her husband had announced his intention of throwing a party, was asleep almost as soon as her head touched the pillow. And the children heard Lou downstairs, booming out bonhomie without her. Trent suspected that he was even a little relieved not to have to contend with his scurrying, frightened mouse of a wife any more. He never once broke away to come up and check on her. Not once. Not until the party was over. After the last guest had been shown out, he walked heavily upstairs and told her to wake up, which she did. Obedient in this as she had been in everything else since the day when she had made the mistake of telling the minister she did, and Lou that she would. Lou poked his head into Trent's room next and measured the children with his gaze. I knew you'd all be in here, he said with a satisfied little nod. Conspiring. You're going to be punished, you know. Yes, indeed. Tomorrow. Tonight I want you to go right to bed and think about it. Now go to your rooms, and no creeping around either. Neither Lissa nor Brian did any creeping around, certainly. They were too exhausted and emotionally wrung out to do anything but go to bed and fall immediately asleep. But Laurie came back down to Trent's room in spite of Daddy Lou, and the two of them listened in silent dismay as their stepfather upbraided their mother for daring to faint at his party, and as their mother wept and offered not a word of argument or even demurral. "Oh, Trent, what are we going to do?" Laurie asked, her voice muffled against his shoulder. Trent's face was extraordinarily pale and still. Do, he said. Why, we're not going to do anything, Spratt. We have to, Trent. We have to. We have to help her. No, we don't, Trent said. A small and somehow terrible smile played around his lips. The house is going to do it for us. He looked at his watch and calculated. At around 3:34 tomorrow afternoon, the house is going to do it all. There were no punishments in the morning. Lou Evans was too preoccupied with his 8 o'clock seminar on consequences of the Norman conquest. Neither Trent nor Laurie was very surprised at this, but both were extremely grateful. He told them he would see them in his study that night, one by one, and meet a few fair strokes to each. Once this threat in the form of an obscure quotation had been given, he marched out with his head up and his briefcase clasped firmly in his right hand. Their mother was still asleep when his Porsche snarled its way down the street. The two younger kids were standing by the kitchen, with their arms around each other, looking to Laurie like an illustration from a Grimm's fairy tale. Lissa was crying. Brian was keeping a stiff upper lip, at least so far. But he was pale, and there were purple pouches under his eyes. He'll spank us, Brian said to Trent, and he spanks hard, too. Nope, Trent said. They looked at him hopefully, but dubiously. Lou had, after all, promised spankings. Even Trent was not to be spared this painful indignity. But Trent, Lissa began. Listen to me, Trent said, pulling a chair out from the table and sitting on it backward in front of the two little ones. Listen carefully, and don't you miss a single word. It's important, and none of us can screw up. They stared at him silently with their big green-blue eyes. As soon as school is out, I want you two to come right home, but only as far as the corner of Maple and Walnut. Have you got that? Yes, Lissa said hesitantly. But why, Trent? Never mind, Trent said. His own eyes, also green-blue, were sparkling. But Laurie thought it wasn't a good-humored sparkle. She thought, in fact, that there was something dangerous about it. Just be there. Stand by the mailbox. You have to be there by 3 o'clock, 3:15 at the latest. Do you understand? Yes, Brian said, speaking for both of them. We got it. Laurie and I will already be there, or we'll be there right after you get there. How are we going to do that, Trent? Laurie asked. We don't even get out of school until 3 o'clock, and I have band practice and the bus takes. We're not going to school today, Trent said. No. Laurie was nonplussed. Lissa was horrified. Trent, she said, you can't do that. That's hooky. And about time, too, Trent said grimly. Now you two get ready for school. Just remember, the corner of Maple and Walnut at 3 o'clock, 3:15 at the absolute latest, and whatever you do, don't come all the way home. He stared at Brian and Lissa so fiercely that they looked back with frightened dismay, drawing together for mutual comfort once again. Even Laurie was frightened. Wait for us, but don't you dare come back into this house, he said. Not for anything. When the little kids were gone, Laurie seized his shirt and demanded to know what was going on. It has something to do with what's growing in the house. I know it does, and if you want me to play hooky and help you, you better tell me what it is, Trent Bradbury. Mellow out, I'll tell you, Trent said. He carefully removed his shirt from Laurie's tight grip. And quiet down. I don't want you to wake up Mom. She'll make us go to school, and that's no good. Well, what is it? Tell me. Come on downstairs, Trent said. I want to show you something. He led her downstairs to the wine cellar. Trent wasn't completely sure Laurie would ride along with what he had in mind. It seemed awfully, well, final, even to him. But she did. If it had just been a matter of enduring a spanking from Daddy Lou, he didn't think she would have. But Laurie had been as deeply affected by the sight of her mother lying senseless on the living room floor as Trent had been by his stepfather's unfeeling reaction to it. Yeah, Laurie said bleakly, I think we have to. She was looking at the blinking numbers on the arm of the chair. They now read 074921. The wine cellar was no longer a wine cellar at all. It stank of wine, true enough, and there were piles of shattered green glass on the floor amid the twisted ruins of their father's wine racks. But it now looked like a madman's version of the control bridge on the Starship Enterprise. Dials whirled. Digital readouts flickered, changed, flickered again. Lights blinked and flashed. Yeah, Trent said. I think so, too. That son of a bitch shouting at her like that. Trent, don't. He's a jerk, a bastard, a dickhead. But this was just a foul-mouthed version of whistling past the graveyard, and both of them knew it. Looking at the strange agglomeration of instruments and controls made Trent feel almost sick with doubt and unease. He was reminded of a book his dad had read him when he was a child, a Mercer Mayer story where a creature called a stamp-eating Trollisk had popped a little girl into an envelope and mailed her to whom it may concern. Wasn't that pretty much what he was proposing they do to Lou Evans? If we don't do something, he'll kill her, Laurie said in a low voice. Huh? Trent whipped his head around so fast it hurt his neck, but Laurie wasn't looking at him. She was looking at the red numbers of the countdown. They reflected backward off the lenses of the spectacles she wore on school days. She seemed almost hypnotized, unaware Trent was looking at her, perhaps even unaware that he was there. Not on purpose, she said. He might even be sad, for a while anyway, because I think he does love her, sort of, and she loves him. You know, sort of. But he'll make her worse and worse. She'll get sick all the time, and then one day... She broke off and looked at him, and something in her face scared Trent worse than anything in their strange, changing, sneaking house had been able to do. Tell me, Trent, she said. Her hand grasped his arm. It was very cold. Tell me how we're going to do it. They went up to Lou's study together. Trent was prepared to ransack the place if that was what it took, but they found the key in the top drawer, tucked neatly into an envelope with the word study printed on it in Lou's small, neat, somehow hemorrhoidal printing. Trent put it in his pocket. They left the house together just as the shower on the second floor went on, meaning their mom was up. They spent the day in the park. Although neither of them spoke of it, it was the longest day either of them had ever lived through. Twice they saw the beat cop and hid in the public toilets until he was gone. This was no time to be caught playing truant and bundled off to school. At 2:30, Trent gave Laurie a quarter and walked her to the phone booth on the east side of the park. "Do I have to?" she asked. "I hate to scare her, especially after last night." "Do you want her in the house when whatever happens, happens?" Trent asked. Laurie dropped the quarter into the telephone with no further protest. It rang so many times that she became sure their mother had gone out. That might be good, but it might also be bad. It was certainly worrisome. If she was out, it was entirely possible that she might come back before. Trent, I don't think she's... Hello? Mrs. Evans said in a sleepy voice. Oh, hi, Mom, Laurie said. I didn't think you were there. I went back to bed, she said with an embarrassed little laugh. I can't seem to get enough sleep all of a sudden. I suppose if I'm asleep, I can't think about how horrible I was last night. Oh, Mom, you weren't horrible. When a person faints, it isn't because she wants to. Laurie, why are you calling? Is everything okay? Sure, Mom. Well, Trent poked her in the ribs hard. Laurie, who had been slumping, growing smaller, it almost seemed, straightened up in a hurry. I hurt myself in gym. Just, you know, a little. It's not bad. What did you do? Jesus, you're not calling from the hospital, are you? Gosh, no, Laurie said hastily. It's just a sprained knee. Mrs. Kitt asked if you could come and bring me home early. I don't know if I can walk on it. It really hurts. I'll come right away. Try not to move it at all, honey. You could have torn a ligament. Is the nurse there? Not right now. Don't worry, Mom. I'll be careful. Will you be in the nurse's office? Yes, Laurie said. Her face was as red as the side of Brian's radio flyer wagon. I'll be right there. Thanks, Mom. Bye. She hung up and looked at Trent. She drew in a deep breath and then let it out in a long, trembly sigh. That was fun, she said in a voice which was close to tears. He hugged her tight. You did great, he said. Lots better than I could have, Laurie. I'm not sure she would have believed me. I wonder if she'll ever believe me again, Laurie asked bitterly. She will, Trent said. Come on. They went over to the west side of the park, where they could watch Walnut Street. The day had turned cold and dim. Thunderheads were forming overhead, and a chilly wind was blowing. They waited for 5 endless minutes, and then their mother's Subaru passed them, heading rapidly toward Greendown Middle School, where Trent and Laurie went. Where we go when we're not playing hooky, that is, Laurie thought. She's really humming, Trent said. I hope she doesn't get into an accident or something. Too late to worry about that now. Come on. Laurie had Trent's hand and was pulling him back toward the telephone kiosk again. You get to call Lou, you lucky devil. He put in another quarter and punched the number of the History Department office, referring to a card he had taken from his wallet. He had barely slept a wink the night before, but now that things were set in motion, he found himself cool and calm. So cool, in fact, that he was almost refrigerated. He glanced at his watch. 3:15. Less than an hour to go. Thunder rumbled faintly in the west. History Department, a woman's voice said. Hi, this is Trent Bradbury. I need to speak with my stepfather, Lewis Evans, please. Professor Evans is in class, the secretary said, but he'll be out at... I know he's got modern British history until 3:30, but you'd better get him just the same. It's an emergency. It concerns his wife. A pointed, calculated pause, and then he added, my mom. There was a long pause, and Trent felt a moment of faint alarm. It was as if she were thinking of refusing or dismissing him, emergency or no emergency, and that was most definitely not in the plan. He's in Oglethorpe, right next door, she said finally. I'll get him myself. I'll have him call home as soon as... No, I have to hold on, Trent said. But, please, will you just stop goofing with me and go get him? He asked, allowing a ragged, harried note into his voice. It wasn't hard. All right, the secretary said. It was impossible to tell if she was more disgruntled or worried. If you could tell me the nature of the... No, Trent said. There was an offended sniff, and then he was on hold. Well, Laurie asked. She was dancing from foot to foot like someone who needs to go to the bathroom. I'm on hold. They're getting him. What if he doesn't come? Trent shrugged. Then we're sunk. But he'll come. You wait and see. He wished he could be as confident as he sounded, but he did still believe this would work. It had to work. We left it until awful late. Trent nodded. They had left it until awful late, and Laurie knew why. The study door was solid oak, plenty strong, but neither of them knew anything about the lock. Trent wanted to make sure Lou had only the shortest possible time to test it. What if he sees Brian and Lissy on the corner when he comes home? If he gets as hot under the collar as I think he will, he wouldn't notice them if they were on stilts and wearing day-glow dunce caps, Trent said. Why doesn't he answer the darn phone? Laurie asked, looking at her watch. He will, Trent said, and then their stepfather did. Hello? It's Trent, Lou. Mom's in your study. Her headache must have come back because she fainted. I can't wake her up. You better come home right away. Trent was not surprised at his stepfather's first stated object of concern. It was, in fact, an integral part of his plan, but it still made him so angry his fingers turned white on the phone. My study? My study? What the hell was she doing in there? In spite of his anger, Trent's voice came out calmly. Cleaning, I think. And then tossed the ultimate bait to a man who cared a great deal more for work than wife. There are papers all over the floor. I'll be right there, Lou rapped, and then added, If there are any windows open in there, shut them, for God's sake. There's a storm coming. He hung up without saying goodbye. Well? Laurie asked as Trent hung up. He's on his way, Trent said, and laughed grimly. The son of a bitch was so stirred up he didn't even ask what I was doing home from school. Come on. They ran back to the intersection of Maple and Walnut. The sky had grown very dark now, and the sound of thunder had become almost constant. As they reached the blue U.S. mailbox on the corner, the streetlights along Maple Street began to come on two by two, marching away from them up the hill. Lissa and Brian hadn't arrived yet. I want to come with you, Trent, Laurie said, but her face proclaimed her a liar. It was very pale, and her eyes were too large, swimming with unshed tears. No way, Trent said. Wait here for Brian and Lissa. At their names, Laurie turned and looked down Walnut Street. She saw two kids coming, hurrying along with lunchboxes bouncing in their hands. Although they were too far away to make out faces, she was pretty sure it was them, and she told Trent, Good. The three of you go behind Mrs. Redland's hedge there and wait for Lou to pass. Then you can come up the street. But don't go in the house, and don't let them either. Wait for me outside. I'm afraid, Trent. The tears had begun to spill down her cheeks now. Me too, Sprat, he said, and kissed her swiftly on the forehead. But it'll all be over soon. Before she could say anything else, Trent went running up the street toward the Bradbury's house on Maple Street. He glanced at his watch as he ran. It was 3:12. The house had a still, hot air that scared him. It was as if gunpowder had been spilled in every corner, and people he could not see were standing by to light unseen fuses. He imagined the clock in the wine cellar ticking relentlessly away, now reading 00:19:06. What if Lou was late? No time to worry about that now. Trent raced up to the third floor through the still, combustible air. He imagined he could feel the house stirring now, coming alive as the countdown neared its conclusion. He tried to tell himself that imagination was all it was, but part of him knew better. He went into Lou's study, opened two or three file cabinets and desk drawers at random, and threw the papers he found all over the floor. This took only a few moments, but he was just finishing when he heard the Porsche coming up the street. Its engine wasn't snarling today. Lou had it wound up to a scream. Trent stepped out of the office and into the shadows of the third-floor hallway, where they had drilled the first holes, what seemed like a century ago. He rammed his hand into his pocket for the key, and his pocket was empty except for an old, crumpled lunch ticket. I must have lost it running up the street. It must have bounced right out of my pocket. He stood there, sweating and frozen, as the Porsche squealed into the driveway, its engine cut out. The driver's door opened and slammed shut. Lou's footsteps ran for the back door. Thunder crumped like an artillery shell in the sky. A stroke of bright lightning forked through the gloom. And somewhere deep in the house, a powerful motor turned over, uttered a low, muffled bark, and then began to hum. Jesus, oh Jesus, what do I do? What can I do? He's bigger than me. If I try to hit him over the head, he'll... He had slipped his left hand into his other pocket, and his thoughts broke off as it touched the old-fashioned metal teeth of the key. At some point during the long afternoon in the park, he must have transferred it from one pocket to the other without even being aware of it. Gasping, heart galloping in his stomach and throat as well as in his chest, Trent faded back down the hall to the luggage closet, stepped inside and pulled the accordion-style doors most of the way shut in front of him. Lou was galumphing up the stairs, bawling his wife's name over and over at the top of his voice. Trent saw him appear, hair standing up in spikes. He must have been running a hand through it as he drove. His tie askew, big drops of sweat standing out on his broad, intelligent forehead. Eyes squinted down to furious little slits. Catherine! He bawled, and ran down the hall into the office. Before he could even get all the way in, Trent was out of the luggage closet and running soundlessly back down the hall. He would have just one chance, if he missed the keyhole, if the tumblers failed to turn at the first twist of the key. If either of those things happens, I'll fight with him, he had time to think. If I can't send him alone, I'll make damn sure to take him with me. He grabbed the door and banged it shut so hard that a little film of dust shot out of the cracks between the hinges. He caught one glimpse of Lou's startled face, then the key was in the lock. He twisted it, and the bolt shot across an instant before Lou struck the door. "Hey!" Lou shouted. "Hey, you little bastard! What are you doing? Where's Catherine? Let me out of here!" The knob twisted fruitlessly back and forth. Then it stopped, and Lou rained a fusillade of blows on the door. "Let me out of here right now, Trent Bradbury, before you get the worst beating of your goddamn life!" Trent backed slowly across the hall. When his shoulder struck the far wall, he gasped. The key to the study, which he had removed from the keyhole without even thinking about it, dropped from his fingers and thumped to the faded hall runner between his feet. Now that it was done, reaction set in. The world began to look wavery as if he were underwater, and he had to fight to keep from fainting himself. Only now, with Lou locked in, his mother sent off on a wild goose chase, and the other kids safely tucked away behind Mrs. Redland's overgrown yew hedge, did he realize that he had never really expected it would work at all. If Daddy Lou was surprised to find himself locked in, Trent Bradbury was absolutely amazed. The doorknob of the study twisted back and forth in short, sharp half-circles. "Let me out, goddammit!" "I'll let you out at 4:15, Lou," Trent said in an uneven, trembling voice, and then a little giggle escaped him. "If you're still here at 4:15, that is." Then, from downstairs, "Trent, Trent, are you all right?" Dear God, that was Laurie. "Are you, Trent?" And Lissa. "Hey, Trent, you okay?" And Brian. Trent looked at his watch and was horrified to see it was 3:31 going on 3:32. And suppose his watch was slow. "Get out!" he screamed at them, plunging down the hallway toward the stairs. "Get out of this house!" The third-floor hallway seemed to stretch out before him like taffy. The faster he ran, the farther it seemed to stretch ahead of him. Lou rained blows on the door and curses on the air. Thunder boomed, and from deep within the house came the ever more urgent sound of machines waking to life. He reached the stairwell at last and hurried down, his upper body so far out in front of his legs that he almost fell. Then he was whirling around the newel post and hurtling down the flight of stairs between the second floor and the first, toward where his brother and two sisters waited, looking up at him. "Out!" he screamed, grabbing them, shoving them toward the open door in the stormy blackness outside. "Quick!" "Trent, what's happening?" Brian asked. "What's happening to the house? It's shaking." It was, too, a deep vibration that rose up through the floor and rattled Trent's eyeballs in their sockets. Plaster dust began to sift down into his hair. "No time! Out! Fast! Laurie, help me!" Trent swept Brian into his arms. Laurie grabbed Lissa under the arms of her dress and stumbled out the door with her. Thunder bammed, lightning twisted across the sky. The wind that had been gasping earlier now began to roar like a dragon. Trent heard an earthquake building under the house. As he ran out through the door with Brian, he saw electric blue light, so bright it left after images on his eyes for almost an hour. He reflected later he was lucky not to have been blinded. Shoot out through the narrow cellar windows. It cut across the lawn in rays that looked almost solid. He heard the glass break, and just as he passed through the door, he felt the house rising under his feet. He jumped down the front steps and grabbed Laurie's arm. They stumbled, staggered down the walk to the street, which was now as black as night with the coming of the storm. There they turned back and watched it happen. The house on Maple Street seemed to gather itself. It no longer looked straight and solid. It seemed to jitter, like a comic strip picture of a man on a pogo stick. Huge cracks ran out from it, not only in the cement walk, but in the earth surrounding it. The lawn pulled apart in huge pie-shaped turbs of grass. Roots strained blackly upward below the green, and the whole front yard seemed to become bubble-shaped, as if it were straining to hold the house before which it had spread so long. Trent cast his eyes up to the third floor, where the light in Lou's study still shone. Trent thought the sound of breaking glass had come, was still coming, from up there, then dismissed the idea as imagination. How could he hear anything in all that racket? It was only a year later that Laurie told him she was quite sure she had heard their stepfather screaming from up there. The foundation of the house first crumbled, then cracked, then sundered with a croak of exploding mortar. Brilliant cold blue fire lanced out. The children covered their eyes and staggered back. The engine screamed. The earth pulled up and up in a last agonized holding action, and then let go. Suddenly, the house was a foot above the ground, resting on a pad of bright blue fire. It was a perfect liftoff. Atop the center roof peak, the weather vane spun madly. The house rose slowly at first, then began to gather speed. It thundered upward on its flaring pad of blue fire, the front door clapping madly back and forth as it went. "My toys!" Brian bleated, and Trent began to laugh wildly. The house reached a height of 30 yards, seemed to poise itself for its great leap upward, then blasted into the rushing spate of night-black clouds. It was gone. Two shingles came floating down like large black leaves. "Look out, Trent!" Laurie cried out a second or two later and shoved him hard enough to knock him over. The rubber-backed welcome mat thwacked into the street where he had been standing. Trent looked at Laurie. Laurie looked back. "That would have smarted like Big Blue Heck if it had hit you on the head," she told him. "So you just better not call me Spratt anymore, Trent." He looked at her solemnly for several seconds, then began to giggle. Laurie joined in. So did the little ones. Brian took one of Trent's hands. Lissa took the other. They helped pull him to his feet, and then the four of them stood together, looking at the smoking cellar hole in the middle of the shattered lawn. People were coming out of their houses now, but the Bradbury children ignored them. Or perhaps it would be truer to say the Bradbury children didn't know they were there at all. "Wow," Brian said reverently. "Our house took off, Trent." "Yeah," Trent said. "Maybe wherever it's going, there'll be people who want to know about the Normans and the Sexies," Lissa said. Trent and Laurie put their arms around each other and began to shriek with mingled laughter and horror, and that was when the rain began to pelt down. Mr. Slattery from across the street joined them. He didn't have much hair, but what he did have was plastered to his gleaming skull in tight little bunches. "What happened?" he screamed over the thunder, which was almost constant now. "What happened here?" Trent let go of his sister and looked at Mr. Slattery. "True space adventures," he said solemnly, and that set them all off again. Mr. Slattery cast a doubtful, frightened look at the empty cellar hole, decided discretion was the better part of valor, and retreated to his side of the street. Although it was still pouring buckets, he did not invite the Bradbury children to join him, nor did they care. They sat down on the curb, Trent and Laurie in the middle, Brian and Lissa on the sides. Laurie leaned toward Trent and whispered in his ear, "We're free." "It's better than that," Trent said. "She is." Then he put his arms around all of them. By stretching, he could just manage. And they sat on the curb in the pouring rain and waited for their mother to come home.